episode of the Pinkie Pod. You know the rest. What's going on out there?
You alive? You doing okay?
You enjoying autumn?
I am. I'm doing this a little bit late. It's normally out by now on a Friday.
I'm actually recording this right now.
Almost 8 a.m. on Friday.
Almost October.
It's beautiful and cloudy and about 57 degrees outside. Yes, I love autumn. We've still had a couple of stupid 80 degree days recently, and I think we're supposed to have another one. Yes, I said stupid. Come on. It's pretty much October. What's up with that? We're in Seattle. It's ridiculous. And as I look out the window here, I see a husky across the other block on a balcony. Might be looking at me. Maybe not. Can't really tell.
Anyway, that's the morning. What have you been watching out there? Are you watching Rings of Power? I just watched episode 6. That one was pretty good. It's definitely being stretched out thin. That's my opinion. Don't yell at me. It's very beautiful, but I've had a hard time being emotionally attached to anyone. I'm not sure why. I mean, I guess I'm not really feeling it with some of these characters. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think of it? I also am not one of these people who's going to crap all over it either, though. I think that's ridiculous. Let's see, what else? House of the Dragon. Definitely a little more my style. Enjoying that. Getting pretty crazy. The Sandman is still my favorite. I don't know how many times I've watched it now. Netflix needs to hurry up already and say that it's been renewed. Damn it. And I've been watching football. What about you guys? As far as video games, I did some of the DLC for Immortals Phoenix Rising, which is a lot of fun. Ooh! And it's very close now that God of War Ragnarok will be coming out. That one I'm looking very forward to. How about you guys? But enough about that blathering. I'll blather some more at the end of the episode. I don't think it's going to be a very long one. Full disclosure, I did not write anything for this one this time. It's a quasi-Google roulette. I actually pulled these things up before I started recording, so they're not completely blind. I decided that I would have a theme for this episode of haunted bodies of water, or not even hauntings around water, or just things involving water. We're going to start out slow, simple, with a couple of lighthouses, and then we'll get to some lagoons and a swamp, and I think I'll save the really creepy one for last. I'm not even going to say what it is yet. Let's start off. This will be very brief. There aren't a lot of tales about it, but it's a place I've been because I have a thing for lighthouses, and I do live in the Pacific Northwest. So the first one is Hasita Head Lighthouse, which is also now bed and breakfast. I suppose there's bread at breakfast. Bed and breakfast. Let me see if I can set this stage for you. It's one of those more classic ones, kind of out on its own cliff. You know, it's not been swallowed up by a town, right? Some have, you know, they're very much in town, practically. This has... The keeper's quarters is actually down a ways from it. You would still, you know, kind of hike it up to the lighthouse on the cliff. And it was a pretty good size that they split internally, I should say, into two. So I think there's basically just two places to stay, two halves, kind of like townhouses. And from what I understand, it's fairly expensive. But I had also heard that they give you like a 7-course breakfast. So there's that. You would definitely be secluded and right on the ocean with the wind gusting and the rocks and the very, very beautiful. The lighthouse itself has a first order Fresnel lens, which they don't even make those anymore. And there's maybe like one person in the world who even works on them. They kind of look like little bullseyes. Basically, on the inside, you would have the little tiny light that looks almost like a candle, right? And it's those lenses that amplify it. I told you I got a thing for lighthouses. I've been inside this one. It's gorgeous. And it's probably the biggest Fresnel lens. I think it's about 9 feet in diameter, at least in this part of the United States. The biggest one is probably on Hawaii.
but in the, do we say continental U.S.? And it's actually operating. There's only three that even operate. Two of them are on Hawaii. There's your little crash course. So Hasita Head Lighthouse, as they say here at hauntedrooms.com, looks like it came straight out of a book. There are well-appointed rooms, and we're talking about what's been converted to the B&B. A handcrafted wooden staircase, and it's one of the most unique bed and breakfasts today. It's listed as one of the top 10 most haunted lighthouses, and so a night there should surely be unforgettable. And this is where I interject and tell you that I know I've seen it on a couple of most haunted type shows or those Travel Channel type, you know, hauntings that particularly used to be all the rage around Halloween. I say used to be because now I think you can pretty much watch it all year round. This is located along the coastline of Yahats, Oregon. I think of it as being closer to Florence, as I recall when I went there, but whatever. The legendary Hasita Head Lighthouse Inn sits just next to the Keeper's House. It's reported that the Keeper's House is haunted. The lighthouse has been sitting on the rocky point for more than 100 years, and the Keeper's House has been turned into a bed and breakfast, as I already told you. The ghost believed to be living in the Keeper's House is that of a woman named Rue. She is described as having silver hair, and she is always seen wearing a long, dark dress. According to the legends, she is the wife of a past light keeper or the mother of a girl who fell on the cliffs and died. They say that Rue doesn't like her home being disturbed by others, and like when volunteers were painting the house, for example, fire alarms kept going off. That could probably be explained, but who knows? One of the workers even had to get up to make sure that there was no fire. Once he made sure there was no fire, he goes back to bed, but then the alarm went off again. And this time he removed the battery, but supposedly the alarm kept going off. Then there was a workman who was cleaning the attic, and I know I saw this in a TV show. They say that he saw Rue up close, and he was so frightened that he fled and refused to return to the attic. A few days later, he broke the attic window by accident while working on the building's exterior. And because of his previous encounter, he repaired the broken window from the outside. And during the night, workers then heard scraping noises in the attic. And when they woke up the next morning, they saw the broken glass in one neat little pile. So the assumption, of course, is that Rue swept it up. A little bit of history is that it was constructed in 1894. It's become a historic landmark that features period antique furnishings. One of the inn's most unique features is its handcrafted wooden staircase, which leads to guests' accommodation. It has been placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1978. The site of the B&B originally included several buildings. However, those were demolished in 1940. And after they put electricity in the house, keepers, of course, were no longer needed. In 1963, the keepers moved away, and what remained of the house was leased to Lane Community College in 1970. And the porch of the Queen Anne House was renovated in 1981. It's a very beautiful area. And of course, as always, I will put photographs of these things that I'm talking about on my Instagram, Pinky_podcast. You can also always find me on Twitter at @PodPinky. A little more here. Actually, I was wrong. It's not done like townhouses. There are six unique guest rooms. The Mariner 1 and the Mariner 2 have the best views of the Pacific Ocean. When you check into those rooms, you will be able to see waves pass by and crash into the rocks. Sounds awesome. They each have a private bath. The Lightkeeper's Room is one of the inn's most popular rooms. It has an exclusive view of the lighthouse, hence the name Victoria's Room, because it's the room where previous lightkeepers slept. It also has a modern private bath, marble shower, and a spacious closet. Then you have Cape Cove Room, which people say is the coziest room in the place. It has a beautiful view of the historic Cape Creek Bridge. That's right, you go down under a bridge too. The whole area is just stunning. I'll see if any of my personal photographs are still on my laptop or somewhere, because I went there years ago. If I find them, I'll share them.
But it was designed by Conde McCullough, who is one of the most respected architects in the United States. And then you have a Queen Anne room, which is the most romantic room. It has a four-poster bed with Austrian shears. The forest and the garden can be seen from the room's window, and they even provide terry cloth robes. The place is also close to the Oregon Dunes National Recreation Area. This is about a 40 to 50 mile stretch of windswept sand dunes that doesn't really occur anywhere else in the United States. Not like this. I mean, you would swear it's like the Sahara Desert, except it's on the ocean. It's insane. I have not really had opportunity to get out and explore the dunes. When I was on my mad dash down, it was like a birthday trip in March, not recently, but down the coast to stop at every single lighthouse. And I also wanted to say that I had made it into California, which I can say that I did. It was stormy and windy and a little bit rainy, which was kind of perfect, but it got crazier the farther south I went. And so I didn't really have time to get out and explore everything, but I did stop at every lighthouse. Cape Blanco is probably the most dramatic, the last one before California. Look it up. There's golf courses and all kinds of things down around there too. Whale watching. It's just a gorgeous area. But we're going to move on to the tallest lighthouse in Oregon, which of course I've also been here as well. And that would be the Yaquina Head Lighthouse. On a scenic basalt rock headland that juts almost a mile into the Pacific Ocean stands a beautiful white lighthouse. At 93 feet tall, the Yaquina Head Lighthouse, located in Newport, Oregon, is the state's tallest. It's been guiding ships for 145 years. It was first lit August 20, 1873, and it has gained quite the storied history. This includes two ghost stories. One tale tells of a construction worker helping to build the tower, who then fell to his death. His body was lodged between the double walls, never retrieved. He and his ghost have been sealed in ever since. So in case that's not clear, he's trapped in between sections of the tower, supposedly. Like, he just got cemented all the way in. The second tale is that in the 1920s, there was a keeper, Smith, who went into town and left someone named Higgins in charge. But Higgins got sick, and he asked another keeper named Story to take over. So we have Smith, Higgins, and Story. When Smith saw from Newport that the lighthouse beacon wasn't lit, the beacons aren't lit. So he rushed back, and he found Higgins dead, and Story was drunk. So Story, who was overtaken with guilt, feared the ghost of Higgins, and from then on would take his bulldog up into the tower with him. As with most ghost stories, the authenticity of this is highly in doubt. The first story is unauthenticated, and the second story is impossible. It's a great tale, but unfortunately not supported by the facts that Story and Higgins didn't serve at the same time at Yaquina Head, and Higgins did not meet his demise in the tower. Higgins left the lighthouse service before 1920 and returned to live with his mother in Portland. Second assistant keeper did die of a heart attack in the watchroom atop the tower in March 1921, but he too served before the arrival of Frank Story. So, there could be a ghost. And it's interesting that the person who actually died there is not in one of the famous tales. I guess it's not as good as, like, leaving and then coming back to this mystery of a drunk guy and a dead guy. I wonder if there are stories about them, like, did he murder him? Probably. That makes for a more dramatic story, right? I want to tell you a little bit about this area that you have tons of seabirds. There's an educational center. It's this whole area. There are seals that hang out down in one area, tide pools. And my favorite little section where you go down before you reach the lighthouse, if you were there, let me put it this way, if you were looking towards the lighthouse and you went to your left and down some stairs, I call it the talking beach. It's this little crescent section. You'll have the big cliff behind you once you walk down. And the rocks are breccia, which are water-smoothed volcanic rocks down there. They're very, you know, oval, round, very smooth.
And what's amazing about it is the water will come in and then it pulls them out like marbles, right? So you hear it. You know, I don't know if you know what a sea drum is. It's filled with like BBs. They look, you know, little metal balls. And you can roll that around to sound like waves crashing. It's kind of like that, but like giant marbles. You want to watch your footing, obviously, because it will pull those rocks out from under you. But it's one of my favorite places on the coast. It is really just astounding. This one also has a first order Fresnel lens, but it is now automated. And it has a 1,000-watt globe. By the way, all lighthouses also have their own pattern. They are the original GPS. Sailors knew where they were by watching the pattern of the lights. For example, this one has 2 seconds on, two off, two on, and 14 off. And this repeats. And I have stayed at a place called the Sylvia Beach Hotel in the Jane Austen room. It's based on famous authors, for the record. It's very cool. It has a restaurant called the Table of Contents. Wonderful place if you're ever there. And I had a view of the lighthouse, so I could lay there at night and I watched this from my window and I counted that pattern. So yes, I can verify it.
I feel like these have made me want to maybe look up some other lighthouse stories.
You know, there was that movie, The Lighthouse. I don't know if you watched it or not, but you have the keepers, you know, that kind of disappear and nobody knows why. And of course, Eggers turned it into a very, he did The Witch as well, and Northman, turned it into a very supernatural and very weird sort of story. But there are stories that's based on. So what say you if I maybe try to dig a couple of those up and get the quote-unquote real story behind the lighthouse? Because I swear I've heard it, like maybe Scotland or somewhere. Let me know. Twitter at PodPinky. But let's move on. Those are just a little taste, just a little taste. Frankly, pretty much every lighthouse has a ghost story. So, you know, I could go on all day with just a quick summary. Look up St. Augustine Lighthouse. Maybe I can add that to the, maybe we can do a double header. That's the oldest city in Florida, and that lighthouse has some of the most compelling footage from paranormal investigators. That one's pretty interesting. But I said we were moving on. This is a body of water as well. We're, you know, now we're going into the water. Truck Lagoon. From shipwrecks to sunken tanks and human remains, it is among the biggest and eeriest underwater graveyards on Earth. Truck Lagoon is a small part of Micronesia located about 1,100 miles northwest of New Guinea in the Western Pacific, and it has been home to several tribes since at least 1528 when Spanish explorers made the first recorded sightings there. Little is known about Truk, also known as Chuk, and I hope I might not be pronouncing these correctly, but there it is. Before that point and after that point, there's not a lot of known about it. Not a lot of da ba da. Boy, I'm on a roll this morning with this speechifying. Okay. Spanish colonialists, colonialists only officially claimed the area, which part of the Caroline Islands, in the late 19th century before they sold it to the Germans in 1899. Then Japan gained possession of Truk Lagoon from Germany when the latter lost it following their defeat in World War I. It was during the next World War that the most dramatic chapter of the history came. This is the thing that made it the biggest graveyard of ships in the world. And a lot of divers like to go there, researchers. They all say it lives up to its title. There's some amazing underwater photographs. Again, I will share Instagram, Pinky_podcast. So during World War II, Japan used Truk Lagoon as one of their main naval bases, anchoring a large portion of their fleet and stationing some 40,000 men there until one fateful American attack. They had suspected that the attack was coming, having realized that Truk was vulnerable after the Americans captured the nearby Marshall Islands, February 3, 1944. Around the same time, the Japanese saw American reconnaissance planes in the skies above Truk.
Thus, the Japanese took the precaution of moving some of their larger warships away, but many of them still remained behind. February 17, 1944, the U.S. Navy commenced Operation Hailstone, a combined air and ground attack that devastated the Japanese position at Truk Lagoon. Over the course of 2 days, American planes sank approximately 50 Japanese ships, destroyed at least 250 Japanese planes, and killed some 4,500 Japanese personnel. It's estimated that on one ship alone, 400 Japanese soldiers who were stuck in the cargo hold were killed. So the mission to neutralize the strength of Truk Lagoon's concentrated Japanese fleet was a success, and it left the area as an insignificant military position for the remainder of the war. And so Japan's forgotten fleet remained in the same exact spot that it had sunk, even for decades after the war ended. The Ghost Fleet of Truk Lagoon is what they call it. So it wasn't until 1869 when famed French explorer, oh, I loved this guy, Jacques Cousteau, filmed an expedition at the wreck site, and it's called Lagoon of Lost Ships, if you can find that documentary. And Truk gained newfound interest. The film showed Cousteau and his team as they found not only the ships, but that some of those ships were full of bodies. This prompted a Japanese recovery effort that saw them pull many bodies, how many is unclear, from the wreckage, and they gave them a proper burial, so that's really nice. Since then, Truk Lagoon is a popular site with divers and researchers. The rarity of having so many intact ships in such close proximity draws in explorers from all over the world. And many who explore it can see the aftermath of Operation Hailstone. In some of the ships, you can see exactly how they were sunk. One was taken down by a torpedo, clearly visible in the middle of the ship. Another one, identified as Gosei Maru, has a huge hole that indicates probably a bomb landing. While some ships, like Gosei Maru, have been identified thanks to explorations over the years, many have not. So for some divers, making those identifications is exactly the challenge and appeal of going there in the first place. And doing that kind of detective work, despite the fact that it's shipwrecks that are more than 70 years old, is made possible in part by the region's crystal clear waters. Some ships that are sitting 50 feet deep in the ocean can actually be seen from above the surface. These pictures I'm telling you are really eerie, and I can't imagine being able to, say, stand on the shore and see these things. Full disclosure here, I both love the ocean and have a healthy fear of it at the same time. I'm sure I'm not the only one. I mean, it's huge and vast and can be deep and dark. And like you see pictures of people swimming with a whale, and I think, oh my God, that's so amazing. And I also think that I would pee my wetsuit, because imagine something that humongous. You suddenly turn around and there it is. How would it not freak you out at first? Wouldn't it? Even a dolphin. Because things just look weird underwater too. You're just in a place where 360 degrees surrounded by sometimes a lot of nothing. And it's so creepy to me in certain ways, like things like this being underwater, that even when I play video games, Assassin's Creed Odyssey is one example, one of my favorite games, I don't do a lot of the underwater swimming where you're supposed to, and I'm probably missing out on all kinds of cool stuff in temples and this and that, but even in a video game, I find it creepy. Laugh at me if you want to, I don't care, but it, for some reason, it still manages to creep me out, even though I'm looking at a, you know, it's on a TV set, I can see that it's all enclosed in there. I don't know, it's not just me, right? I think I mentioned this before. I know there's other people out there. Please tell me so I know I'm not the only one. Anyway, there are not only ships in Truk Lagoon. There are relics that were stored in the sunken ships, like motorcycles, radios, weapons, spare parts, railroad cars, and of course the human remains. Thanks to the appeal of wrecks, it's become an increasingly popular tourist destination, with diving operations springing up to service the demand. And the first dive operation opened in 1973 with Kimio Asek at the helm. He is a native Chukchis. I'm probably butchering that, I'm sorry. And witnessed Operation Hailstone firsthand at the age of 17 when he was working on the docks. He was also an early advocate for protecting the site, and it was Truk Lagoon was designated as a national monument in 1972. The local environment, though, also needs protection from the wrecks, even as they want to protect this as an historical site. Old oil and fuel from the ships actually still leaks into the water, and it's not only a potential hazard for explorers, but corrosion experts say it could lead to the wreck site's complete collapse someday. But while it remains, it represents a haunting reminder of death and devastation over three quarters of a century ago. As Lagoon of Lost Ships states in its closing, and that's the Cousteau documentary, Truk Lagoon presents a mysterious planet of life and death. On the one hand, nature absorbs the artifacts of war, and on the other, she has preserved them. Only centuries from now will every trace of man's follies vanish from the bottom of Truk Lagoon. They don't talk about ghost stories here and everything that I looked up about it, but you can certainly imagine if ever there was a place that would be ripe for ghost stories, that would be the place. And I imagine, and even if it's just psychological, but if you went there knowing what it is, you would immediately get that creepy feeling, wouldn't you? And a feeling of sadness and awe and everything else. And I would be curious if anybody had ever like gone out there and stayed at night, if they have any eerie stories. And sound really travels over water. So I sort of expected that there would be, maybe I should look harder, stories of hearing voices or anything, or screams and shouts. I mean, somebody could set quite the fictional story around there for a ghost story. Maybe they have. Moving on, Changi Beach, Singapore. Besides the continuous torturing, mutilating, and killing both of prisoners of war and civilian captives, which was carried out by the Kempeitai throughout the war, at least several mass executions of Chinese took place shortly after the surrender of Singapore. One was on Changi Beach, or Changi, and the other one offshore. The victims were taken out to sea in launches and then pushed overboard to be machine gunned in the water. During the Sukching operation in February 1942, the site of Changi was one of the first of several where tens of thousands of Chinese suspected of being anti-Japanese were executed by the Japanese Kempeitai. So this area is believed to be haunted by the ghosts of the executed Chinese during the Japanese occupation. Passersby often report hearing strange crying and screaming. The heads of the Chinese dead bodies are sometimes seen flying everywhere. Headless bodies walk around the beach as well. More scary cases include a passerby witnessing a ghostly execution that actually left bloodstains. It is well known that thousands of Chinese civilians were shot dead during the Sukching operation in 1942. However, after the war and the Japanese surrender, Changi Beach served too as an execution grounds for the culprits. It held the war crimes trials. The trials took a few years, as many Japanese war criminals were put on trial. About 135 were executed, all of them at Changi. So now you have that added layer of trauma at this site. There was Lieutenant General S. Fukuye, commander of the prisoners of war camp in 1942, and he was the first to be tried. He had ordered two Australian and two British soldiers to be shot. They were each shot on the shore at Changi. Fukuye was sentenced to be shot himself on the same shore, and he was sentenced to be shot in the same place. Singapore newspapers actually published a photograph of the execution. Next was Vice Admiral Tihara, the general officer commanding the Andaman and the Nicobar Islands, and five of his men were found guilty of murdering 9 Burmese in July 1945. They were hanged June 1946 in the same area. The 2 condemned men were reported to have composed a poem the night before the execution about their impending doom, their last thoughts, and they requested it to be forwarded to their families in Japan. The poem, according to this person, goes something like this. Now we climb the 13 last steps and I shout, long live the emperor. Vice Admiral Hara looked calm, resigned to his death the following morning. He had accepted responsibility for the murder of his men of the 9 Burmese because, he said, he was their commanding officer. Many families and relatives of victims of the death railway came from Australia and England to attend the trial of officers and men accused of crimes in connection with the tragic page of history. They saw Lieutenant Ishida, the general officer commanding of the Thai end of the railway, sentenced to death together with many others, including Colonel Nakamura, Colonel Yanagita, Lieutenant Colonel Ishii, and Major Senda. Many Japanese medical officers were sentenced to long terms in prison, some to life. At the trial of the prisoners of war camp personnel, Major General Saito, Captain Suzuki, and Tomonaga Kobayashi, and Kawazoe were sentenced to death by hanging. This webpage, worldsmosthauntedblogspot.com, has compiled little articles from different areas. Here we have a source, Chongi photographer George Espinales' record of captivity. This is a true story told by a POW witness after the war. You will see the cost of a successful sabotage action happen during wartime. The wrong death was a kind of side effect of an anti-Japanese operation. During the Japanese occupation, the Japanese Air Force had taken over the whole Changi Aerodrome complex, and they were using the old Roberts Barracks as a store and housing for their personnel. In one dark night, the POWs poked around the area and found a lot of Japanese radial aircraft engines. They were sitting on stands, obviously being dismantled and serviced. Some of them had their cylinder heads off, and it would be a chance of sabotaging some of these engines. The place was pretty lightly guarded. A lot of Chinese used to wander about at night, and the Jap guards were rather slack. One night, the POWs were over in the Selarang Barracks area, near a transport garage by the old Changi Theater. The Japanese were using it as a mechanical workshop for trucks and other vehicles, and they noticed a stack of batteries in one corner beside a big battery charger and lots of wicker-covered glass jars. They brought some of those jars back to the Changi jail to test it. When they poured some onto a piece of tin, it ate its way straight through, so it must have been sulfuric acid. They got hold of some of the old pickle jars and half-filled them with the sulfuric acid and made a holder plated out of coconut leaves, as it was very dangerous to handle. In one moonless night, the POWs sneaked into the workshop, groped around until they found the engines with the cylinder heads off. They opened up the pickle jars of acid and carefully brushed it inside the 5 or so cylinders that were on top of the engine. They managed to do about 8 engines before making their way back to Changi Jail as quickly as possible. By this time, Americans were sending B-29 bombers over Singapore, and the Japanese would scramble their Zero fighters to go after them. Several of the fighters returned very quickly after taking off. Some of them didn't make the aerodrome and flew straight into the coconut trees at the end of the runway. The engines were making sputtering noises when the planes came down. Soon after that, there had been some kind of investigation by the Japanese engineers, and they rounded up a lot of Asian workers down there at Changi Beach, made them stand in line for 2 days while they were interrogated. They collected a large group of men of all ages from the villages near Changi area. Later on, groups of 4 or 5 of these men were taken down to Changi Beach and shot. Many innocent Chinese men had been punished for the POW sabotage actions. The Japanese had blamed the Asian workers, and a large number of them were shot. This was quite a large scale of execution after the Suk Ching operation right there at Changi Beach. The innocent victims knew very clearly that they were wronged, but you had to face their doom. These are first told stories, second told stories. The photographs aren't loading here for some reason, but they have pictures taken with zoom and night vision scopes, filled with just tons of orbs. I don't know how I feel about orbs, but lots and lots and lots of orbs. Here's a little story. Paper Umbrella and Changi Point. At Changi Point, jetty, many boats were there shuttling people and goods between Singapore mainland and Pulau Ubin. It costs $2.50 per person even if you carry bulks of goods. However, there is one rule untold to many people. The boat drivers would agree to transport anything except dead bodies. This is their superstition that they cannot mix the live and the dead passengers. If ever they break this rule, they will invite mishaps into their water journeys. But it is true that many people besides tourists are merchants or traders going to and from Pulau Ubin. For example, they have a business or job at Pulau Ubin, but their home is in the mainland. If they unfortunately died away from home, their bodies could not be taken back to the mainland, but to bury in Pulau Ubin. This was quite difficult for most people to accept because every family would prefer to have the soul of the lost one return home. Although their bodies cannot be taken back to the mainland, they require the spirit to come home. One method is to invite along the shaman to the burial location in Pulau Ubin, have some chanting, and summon the spirit to live in an ancestor tablet. That is a wooden altar with the dead person's name written on it. They believe using the wood tablet as a medium, and at least that way they can carry that back to the mainland. But there is one taboo for the boat people. They wouldn't allow a tablet altar to be brought on the boat just as it is. They will lend you a paper umbrella, a traditional old Chinese-style umbrella that is made of paper and bamboo, and the surface of the umbrella is usually waxed and painted. The umbrella is used to cover the tablet together with the joss stick throughout the whole boat journey, regardless if it's a sunny or rainy day, day or night. They believe that this is a must to keep the spirit contained under this paper umbrella, so that the spirit will not flee elsewhere, especially as they're afraid the spirit might choose to stay on their boat. So next time you take a gumboat ride to Ubin, take a look at the roof structure of the jetty shelter and you will see a paper umbrella is placed there. But don't try to touch it and don't try to open it, not even for fun. It is a serious tool used by the boatmen to transport spirits. And that is a little bit about that. Now we're going to come back to America. Manchac Swamp, also known as Ghost Swamp, is a wetland just northwest of New Orleans, Louisiana. The swamp is known for its murky waters and eerie-looking trees. The marsh is also home to alligators that creep around on strangely colored waters while waiting for prey. Scary snakes infest the dark surroundings. Broken logs can be seen floating in the swamp. The woods are remnants of the now abandoned logging towns of Ruddock, Frenier, and Napton. Locals consider the swamp haunted not just because it has direct ties to the Rougarou and Cajun werewolves, but also the black magic and voodoo practices that were passed down from generation to generation. One of the most popular stories is about a voodoo priestess named Julia Brown, whom, according to legend, cursed the swamp before the time of her remarkable death. Who is Julia Brown? According to townsfolk, Julia Brown lived near the end of the swamp and worked in the town of Frenier. Brown was good to the residents, and in return, the people respected her. She helped mothers during childbirth and aided in the curing of illness and infections that were difficult to treat and manage. Based on circulated stories, Brown, a good-spirited person, changed when the village took her for granted. People became ungrateful of her kindness, which led her to practice voodoo and curses that terrified the neighborhood. She was known for making hand gestures that no one could understand and staring at others with an intensity that would terrify a holy man. According to reports, residents of the town heard Brown singing lyrics that had everyone concerned. She predicted terrible things to those people who wronged her. One of the most infamous of Brown's prophecies was about her own death and taking everyone to die with her. Some claim that Julia Brown didn't leave a curse, but only a prediction to warn the townsfolk. Her voodoo practices were only for healing of the sick and wounded. Census records show that Julia was born in Louisiana around 1845 under the name of Julia Bernard. In 1880, she married Celestin Brown and changed her name to Julia Brown. Based on a statement up from the modern New Orleans voodoo priestess Bloody Mary, Brown served as a local healer and she was not a revengeful type of person. She also emphasized that Julia was usually seen singing on her front porch with her guitar. One of the songs had lyrics that went like this. One day I'm going to die and take the whole town with me. The fateful day of the Ghost Swamp, September 29, 1915. A tremendous storm approached the coast of Louisiana. The once prosperous towns of Ruddock, Frenier, and Napton were swept away by a massive hurricane, September 29, 1915. The very same day when Julia Brown was to be laid to rest in the town of Frenier. The storm was a Category 4 with 145-mile-per-hour sustained winds. According to reports, about 300 people died during this terrifying hurricane, and it traveled inland from the Caribbean. By October 1st, any rescuers that arrived could see those entire communities were no more. A few of survivors claimed to see people screaming for life as they were swallowed by the swamp during the powerful destruction. A newspaper in 1915, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, documented Julia Brown's funeral the day of the storm. By the way, that newspaper is still operating. Many pranks were played by wind and tide. I'm quoting here, for the record. Negroes had gathered from miles around to attend the funeral of Aunt Julia Brown, an old negress who was well known in that section and was a big property owner. Aunt Julia had been placed in her casket, and the casket, in turn, had been placed in the customary wooden box and sealed. At 4 o'clock, however, the storm had become so violent that the Negroes left the house in a stampede, abandoning the corpse. The corpse was found Thursday, and so was the wooden box. But the casket has never been found. Many tried to rebuild the town again, but most simply abandoned the island that once was Julia's isolated home. The reputation of Manchac Swamp became a hot spot for paranormal activities and has been featured several times in paranormal TV shows. Visitors and locals report spooky tales of moans, screams, and also from an unknown woman's voice. Cries from the victims of the old hurricane are mentioned, and they can still be faintly heard in the distance. But they never find anybody. No source for these sounds. Residents even say the night air rings to a song similar to what Julia Brown played on her guitar about her strange death. Someone called Babalu the Stink posted a story on Reddit describing his terrifying experience with what he believes was Julia Brown cackling in the swamp. Shall we click it? So I am now reading from Boobaloo the Stink. This is 8 years ago that they posted this. I'm a little new here to Reddit, so I don't know exactly where to post this. I've read some stories here in No Sleep that are genuinely freaky, but some of the stuff I've read here seems made up. No offense. Oh, and he's already offending people, I'm sure. Other stuff seems like it could be genuine, so I'm thinking this is where I spill the beans. If not, can someone kindly direct me to where I should post what happened somewhere else? I was hoping someone else has had a similar experience in Ruddock, Louisiana. Or maybe somebody can point us in the right direction to help us get a little closure. This happened around a month ago. My husband and I are from North Carolina, but my mother recently remarried and moved to Hammond, Louisiana. I am also pregnant, and I desperately needed to take a vacation to see my mom because we both really miss each other and she can't be with me all the time now. Kind of sucks, but it was a great excuse to go see my mom and her new husband and go to a Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans, since it wasn't that far away. That was really for my husband's benefit, but I was really excited to go too because we needed to have a little fun since he has been working overtime ever since we found out about the pregnancy. We thought it would be great to get a hotel for the night and relax and watch the fun from the balcony of our room. We ended up going and having a pretty cool time. I can't walk or stand up constantly without resting or having to pee. So that kind of dampened the experience, but New Orleans is, like, super cool. Scary and wild, but in a fun way. We slept in the next morning after the parade and ate breakfast before making the drive back to my mom's house. It's not very far. It took us about an hour or a little more to get to New Orleans the day before, but I guess I had too much water and orange juice to drink with breakfast, and I knew I wasn't going to make it back to my mom's house without needing to do my business. Traffic was awful trying to get out of New Orleans, and we got lost once trying to figure out how to get back on the interstate. So needless to say, I had to go badly. We saw an exit sign for a town called Ruddock, so my husband took it in the hopes it had a restroom or gas station. From what we could see, there was no gas station or restaurant or anything. We kept driving down this little road just in case and ended up at the edge of the water. It looked like a boat launch where the road disappeared unceremoniously into the swamp water. My husband said we can turn back and find another restroom, but there was no point. I was going to piss all over myself before we found another exit. I asked him to guard me so that I could squat and do my business just in case someone else decided to drive down and launch their boat. So as I'm squatting and trying not to pee on my shoes on the other side of the truck, oh girl, been there, I heard him give a strange laugh. He suddenly jogged around the truck and gave me a smile like he thought something weird was happening. "We've got company," he said, and looked back around the truck. He seemed perplexed but amused. And of course, I tried to finish as fast as possible and wiped with some fast food napkins. She's really into these details. Not my fault, y'all. While he waved his hands to rush me along, I figured whoever it was actually coming to greet us, and I didn't want to be caught with my pants down, literally. I tidied up and followed him around the truck and was kind of relieved to see it was a little old lady walking towards us slowly and awkwardly, as little old ladies are wont to do. "Where did she come from?" I asked my husband. He shrugged and gave me a sideways look that said, "It fucking beats me." But when she waved at us both, we waved back like it was the most normal thing in the world. We didn't feel threatened in any way. My husband muttered, "Yeah, yeah, lady, we fucking see you." And I hit him in the arm so he'd shut up. She looked just like any regular old lady. She was African-American, had thin white hair, and wore a big sack-like dress. It kind of broke my heart to see, suddenly, that she wasn't wearing any shoes. She waddled closer, and I realized how rude we were being and pulled my husband out to meet her stride. I later figured out that we both thought she had Alzheimer's and had somehow wandered away from her family. But it occurred to me how very odd that was, seeing as we were miles from civilization in the heart of the swamplands, and I couldn't see how this lady could just wander down the interstate without someone noticing. It was very clear to us that there was no town of Ruddock. Nothing. Just a railroad track that runs parallel to the interstate and a boat launch. It was kind of unsettling. No houses or signs of life anywhere. When we got up close to her, we knew with swift embarrassment that she stunk. It made me recoil, and my husband told me later that he hadn't ever smelled anything quite like it. There was something acidic to it, like bile and sweat. I knew we had to help this lady somehow, because she obviously had been wandering for a while without shoes, possibly for days. "Hello, miss. It's kind of chilly out here. Are you all right?" my husband asked, as kindly as he could. We were both having trouble trying to stay upwind of her smell. She smiled at us and showed us a few yellowed teeth. I had a creepy feeling about her suddenly. She told us her name was Aunt Julia and kept rocking back and forth on her feet. My husband kept talking to her and asking her if she needed any help, but all I could do was stare at her because something was very off. Still to this day, I can't describe what was truly wrong with her, but it wasn't Alzheimer's. She held up a hand to my husband's face and interrupted him mid-sentence. He was telling her he was going to call someone for her to help her, probably some nice police officers or something. Then Aunt Julia beckoned us to follow her. Instantly, we were both on high alert. My husband told me to keep calm and stay with the truck so he could figure out what was going on, but I held on to his hand because I didn't want him to go with her. "Let's just call the police and wait here," I begged him. "She's just a little old lady. She's wandering away to the water. Look, let me go bring her back if I can, and then we'll call someone," he assured me. He followed her out to the edge of the road where the water met it. I did too. He didn't really feel like arguing with me, so he didn't say anything when he saw that I had followed. The little old lady pointed at something off in the distance in the water. My husband and I both squinted really hard, but all we could see was something bobbing in the distance. "I took him with me," she said. Her voice was stronger and way more menacing than I could have possibly imagined. "Took who?" "Ma'am, please come back with us to the truck. We want to make sure you get home safe," my husband continued to try and reason with her. "I took him with me, just like I said I would." "Mm-hmm," she nodded. I couldn't take my eyes off of her. She looked so angry. It was extremely unsettling, and I watched her walk back and forth on her feet in a restless way. "Oh my God. Oh shit. Go back to the truck, okay? What? Why? What's going on? Call 911. That's a fucking dead body. It's a floater," he shouted, pointing at the thing in the water. Aunt Julia started cackling just like someone you would hear in an insane asylum, and we both froze, me watching her and him watching the body floating, bobbing in the swamp. It was very angry laughter that pricked the hair on my skin up more than the body in the water. I realized she was out of her mind, but not in the way some old ladies are. "I took him with me," she laughed, and several more bodies bobbed up out of the water like submerged corks. I felt my stomach roll, and my husband and I retreated from her. I waddled to the truck and grabbed his phone and dialed 911. I tried to keep my voice steady as I explained that we had found an old lady wandering around by herself off the Riddick exit, and there were a couple of bodies floating in the swamp water. I stayed on the line with the operator for a few more minutes, describing several bodies, women, men, possibly children. I remember breaking down on the line with the emergency operator because of the smaller bodies I'd seen. It's very hard to describe how horrified and upset I was. I also described the old lady and that she seemed to be claiming responsibility for it, but I wasn't sure. I made sure to explain to them that there was something very wrong with her. As I was relaying our location again and our names, my husband kept a close eye on this creepy laughing old lady. She never did stop laughing and repeating herself about how she took them with her, even when the police car showed up. I know the officer saw the bodies. He even managed to smooth talk Aunt Julia into sliding into the back seat of his cruiser. As freaked out as my husband and I were, it would be a huge relief to at least be able to sleep easy later that night, knowing that we had helped a crazy old lady get back to wherever she belonged and help solve some obvious deaths. We chatted with the officer for a little bit, and he assured us that everything would be taken care of and took both of our statements. Soon another cop showed up, and the first one went to check on the old lady.
Aunt Julia was gone.
My husband and I even both looked for her in the back of the cruiser and tried helping the officer search for this lady, but it was getting dark, and I felt my feet getting too tired. Then the first officer noticed that the floaters he had seen in the water were gone, too. Just vanished. Adios. Nothing. Not a shred of clothing or a stretch of skin. Nada. We were about to ask if we could go home soon. I was more than a little shaken, expecting this crazy Aunt Julia to jump out at me from somewhere, when the second officer called my husband over. "What did you say her name was again?" he asked. "She told me her name was Julia," my husband shrugged. I could tell he was tired too and just wanted to go home.
"No, no. She introduced herself as Aunt, right?"
the officer asked. He had this strange look of dawning comprehension that struck a chord with me. Something was up. He even looked a little confused. "Listen, if you folks are trying to pull my leg, I am going to have to accuse you of filing a false police report," he said, pretty sternly. Kind of scared me. My husband bristled, but the first officer to arrive called him over, and we heard him assure the second officer that, yes, he had helped an old lady into the back of his cruiser earlier, and no, nobody was in on any prank. "Can I go? I mean, you've got everything from us if you need to talk to us again," my husband grumbled. They both decided that we could go, but asked us to keep our phones near us since they were going to have to do a search in the swamp at some point and might need immediate contact. So we left, after they checked the truck bed in the inner cab in case Aunt Julia was hiding. My husband and I really don't know what happened after that or if they ever found anything in the water. I don't know if they ever found an old lady either. But what the second officer said about a prank really didn't sit well with me, so when we got back to my mom's house, I peed again and did a little bit of research. I came across a history of Riddick, and it's kind of freaky and sad. It got washed away in a hurricane, and a lot of people died almost 100 years ago. We don't really know what to make of that, except that it's really weird that there would be an interstate sign for a town that doesn't exist anymore. We have come to a tentative conclusion that what we witnessed wasn't entirely rationally explanatory. As in, did we stumble upon some sort of ghost shit? I haven't yet read anything newsworthy about Riddick or a bunch of bodies found floating in the swamp, so I'm guessing nothing much happened after we left. I don't even know Aunt Julia's last name to see if she comes up in some obituary or nursing home escape account. Nothing. Nobody ever called us back, and we never were asked to go to a police station. I'm leaning towards ghost shit. It's just a feeling I get. It's been around a month since it happened, and we still end up talking about it and trying to piece together what might have been going on and what might have happened after the officers let us leave. She made an edit. I went to sleep and woke up to find Cerebus Cat had found this. I haven't gotten a chance to show it to my husband yet.
I guess I'm going to have to click on that link, y'all.
And then there's another edit. Here is a picture of the exit ramp sign that says Riddick. There's nothing down there, guys. All right, let's follow this click. Oh, they showed her the story of the towns. So what do you think, you guys? Do you believe her? What I found interesting as I'm looking at this article and the way it's written, there's a little bit of, you know, if you read books, you know how people write dialogue, right? And that's what she did. So there's a bunch of it that way that almost makes you think that she is a writer, or at least knows how to do that. It's very rare that I have ever seen anybody relay a story with proper quotation marks and dialogue tags.
That doesn't mean that she's lying, okay?
But it gives you the instant impression that this is actually someone who tells stories. Maybe tells stories for a living. Maybe not. It's not perfectly written, but they could have done that on purpose to throw us off. Maybe I can link this article, but it's... Yeah, it's got dialogue tags the way somebody who's writing short stories or novels will do. And everything I've ever read on Reddit with somebody who's just sharing a story is usually doesn't do that at all. They just say, my husband said, and I said, and nobody puts quotation marks. Interesting. Or maybe she's just good at telling a story, even if it isn't, even if it is true. Now, drum roll. I have saved what I think is probably the creepiest one for last. And maybe I'm saying this too because Asian horror films are always the creepiest and they have the best, you know, because they don't have big budgets. They rely a lot on atmosphere, so they're really creepy. If you don't agree with me, let me know why. But I think that that's, they're some of the creepiest. I'm not saying that this is a movie. I'm saying that it is an Asian tale, though. And there probably has probably inspired. They have so many legends they can use as well. You know, the suicide forest, right? Oh my God, which is a real thing. So this final story, Okiku's Well, the epic true story of the haunted Himeji Castle. The term Okiku's Well refers to one of the most well-known legends in Japanese lore, as well as the alleged location where it took place, even though, over time, the story itself has suffered many changes, and there seems to even be some legitimate doubt as to the actual site of the well. It is a very well-established ghost story and haunting that resonates to this day. And I am getting this from realunexplainedmysteries.com. It centers around a castle known as Himeji Castle, which stands above the city of Himeji on top of the hill and dates back to the 14th century. And then it was later amplified and expanded upon, the tale, I believe. The well is located at the base of the castle and is close to what has become known as the Suicide Gates. And this is a place where those who had fallen from grace were compelled to take their lives to restore their lost honor, and is thought to have been used for cleaning up after various harakiri ceremonies that likely took place right next to it. However, the haunting we are going to talk about here has nothing to do with the poor souls who met their demise at the point of their own swords at the suicide gates. That sounds like a separate story all on its own, does it not? The tale of Okiku's Well goes something like this. A long time ago, the story has sometimes been dated somewhere around the 18th century, there was a servant girl living in the Himeji Castle named Okiku. She served the master of the castle, a powerful and wealthy lord, whose most valued treasure, Akiko, was entrusted with guarding. This treasure consisted of 10 gilded plates of incalculable value and great beauty. Apparently, over time, the servant girl developed feelings for the lord of the castle. However, because of her position and difference of status with respect to him, she did not make her feelings known. On one occasion, Okiku accidentally overheard a conversation between a couple of the lord's chiefs, where they appeared to be making plans to conspire to take his life. Naturally, she became fearful for him, and she decided to tell him about the plans she had overheard. However, the chief in question learned that Okiku had revealed his plans to the lord, and therefore turned his murderous intentions towards her. So the chief, who had managed to escape the dominions of Omoji, began to plot against Okiku. The plot. To accomplish this, he decided to steal one of the precious gilded plates that Okiku was entrusted with. Because of the confidence the lord had placed upon her to guard this most valued treasure, once it became clear that one of the plates were stolen, he was convinced that Okiku stole it. Consequently, she was tried and found guilty, not only of theft, but of fabricating a plot against the person of the chief. As punishment for her alleged crimes, and contrary to the more commonplace practice of forcing her to commit ritual suicide by the gates, she was actually murdered via gruesome torture, mutilation, and her lifeless remains were thrown into the well. Could this be the beginning of the rain, y'all? It is even said that the horrendous punishments were inflicted on Okiko by none other than the chief himself. Now, at this point, we should point out that the well-known fact, especially among paranormal researchers, is that it's quite common for hauntings, in particular those that are strictly attached to a specific location or item, originate when a sequence of events takes place in close proximity to the location. And when the events have been, you know, really traumatic, painful, unjust, you know, that's what can really make a haunting. Pardon me if I stumble here a bit. I'm not sure that whoever wrote this, English is their first language. It's worded a bit strangely at times, so I'm fixing it as I go. Okiko's well goes on to explain that every night between the hours of 2 and 3 in the a.m., the restless and deeply troubled soul of the servant girl rises from within the well that had become her watery grave. And of course, I am now picturing this with the black hair, right? I can't do the cracking. All right. What she does once she has risen is what makes this haunted location so compelling. Her soul begins screaming and meticulously counting the gilded plates, starting at 1. And she gets louder as she counts until she gets to 10. This is a very powerful archetype. It's even poignant, touching, and at the same time, bone-chilling. The interesting part is that the ghostly behavior started almost immediately after the events of her death. Every night she would rise and scream the numbers, and every night she would wake up the Lord from his sleep inside the castle. Ultimately, it would appear that the Lord eventually learned about what had actually happened and understood what a great injustice had been committed upon an innocent and honest servant girl. The knowledge combined with the persistent haunting at the well drove him insane. Which, if it's a true story, he deserved it. Conclusion. We do not have any more facts about this story or about what may have occurred in its aftermath. However, it is widely accepted by the local people that Okiku's soul does indeed to this day come out of the well at night to scream the number of gilded plates. Forever in a state of desperate unrest, unable to forgive or forget the terrible wrongdoings of her murderer and the unrequited love she was forced to hold to herself, even in death. Shall we Google just a little extra on this one? I actually think that this sounds a little familiar. I don't know if I heard a podcast on this. I might have. Let's go to a site, popjapan.com. I mean, this might be a more original source. Page doesn't want to load. That sucks. There it is. Now, this one actually does tie it to the ring. And I forgot that the person in the ring is called Sadako. Now, this story goes this way on this page. Hosokawa Katsumoto, the lord of Himeji Castle, got seriously ill. His heir, Tomonosuke, planned to secure the succession of the shogunate by offering a set of 10 precious plates. But the chief retainer, Asayama Tetsuzan, also wanted the shogun title, and so he plotted to murder Tomonosuke. Tetsuzan used a lady-in-waiting named Okiko for the plot, but eventually he fell for her. He fell in love with her, so this is a little different. But she is engaged to another man, Tomonosuke's retainer. Due to Okiko's refusal to accept Tetsuzan, he ordered her to death to be killed in the well located in the grounds of Himeji Castle. Now that is a different story and very interesting. Remember, we talk about those games of telephone and how legends can change. Let's see if we get another version. Let's see. Do, do, do. We're waiting for the page to load. Okay, thewillowweb.com. Japan has hundreds of ghost stories known as, and then they write it in Japanese. How? Okay, this is a great webpage, but of course I can't read that. It is pronounced kaidan. Living near Himeji made it impossible not to learn a kaidan called Banko Sarayashiki. So they're talking, by the way, kaidan, I guess, is a name for ghost stories. Okay, there we go. I'm just so American. What can I say? So kaidan are ghost stories is a word for ghost stories. Gotcha. The title of the okiku and the plates is Bancho Sarayashiki. And there are many versions of it throughout Japan. It is actually often performed as kabuki, which is the theater, the traditional style of Japanese theater. I have a feeling this is going to be a good one. See, now we're doing a little Google roulette. I think I'll just call it Google roulette. We're doing Google roulette. Relay. Google relay. There, it sounds like I'm doing something really fancy when I'm not. So, this is one of the versions of the stories. Himeji Castle has many names. For over 400 years, it has stood dominating the cityscape with its calm, gleaming white walls. My God, y'all, it's just gorgeous. I will definitely share this picture. Glad I came here. And the author of this webpage took the photo themselves right on. It is called White Heron or Egret for its beauty and Miracle for its longevity. And it is, you guys, it's not maybe the temples you normally think of. It is pristine white. But for all their majesty, castles are dangerous places for love. They are filled with secrets and peril. In the 16th century, Himeji was no exception. Like any good tragedy, the story begins with love. Love between a brave warrior called Kinugasa Matanobu and a servant, the beautiful and honest Okiko. Okiko served a powerful, influential samurai named Aoyama Tetsuzan. Now, okay, I'm already forgetting, but in the other one, wasn't it Tetsuzan that fell in love with her or something? Oh, well, I'm getting ahead. Let's see what they say. He was also the regent of Lord Norimoto, the true ruler of the castle. One day, whilst working, Okiko overheard Tetsuzan discussing a plot to kill Lord Norimoto and seize the castle for himself. I think we're about to get a combination of the two stories I read you. Ooh, exciting. Maybe it would have been better if she had never learned of this plot or if she had ignored it. But when life gives you such choices, you either let them slide and what will be, or you take action. Que sera, sera. And Okiko was not a woman to let anything slide. In that moment, she knew she had to do something. She confided in her lover, Matanobu, and his allies, and they promised her things would be well, and that the plot would be foiled. And it was. Lord Norimoto was warned of the attack, and he fled the city. But although he was safe, Himeji Castle and our lovers were not. In Lord Norimoto's absence, Aoyama took control. He was furious that Lord Norimoto had escaped and sought out the traitor. Secrets, secrets in his midst. Who to trust? No one, no one. The only thing awaiting the traitor was death. Fearing for their own lives, one of the warriors betrayed Okiko. They informed Tetsuzan's accomplice, a man named Danshiro, for her role in foiling the plot. It was her, the servant girl. Because of her, Norimoto escaped. Danshiro was a devious, possessive man. He saw Okiko's beauty and planned to make her his own. Instead of informing Tetsuzan of the traitor's identity, he confronted Okiko himself. Secrets, secrets. Beautiful Okiko, marry me and your life will be spared. But Okiko had already given her heart to Matanobu. She refused Danshiro over and over again. No, no, I will not marry you. Not a man to give up. Danshiro tried one final time to gain Akiko's acceptance. He stole one of the 10 valuable plates, which were treasured heirlooms of the Aoyama family. It is easy to frame a servant for theft. All of the plates were here this morning. Who has been in?
Only the servants, my lord.
What were they doing?
Cleaning, my lord. They always dust the plates.
Who dusted the plates today?
Okiku, my lord.
And where is she now?
Okiku was running. From the Otomon Gate to the Hanmaru, in the West Bailey, and in all of the Yagura, through the gardens and every Kurowa, and to the moat and back, running, searching. She crept into Tetsuzan's rooms and counted over and over again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Always 9.
The missing plate was nowhere to be found. Seeing Okiku so desperate, Danshiro seized his chance.
Marry me, Okiku. This is the last time I will ask you. Marry me and I will return the plate and clear your name.
But how could anyone agree to such a proposal when they are already in love with another? Okiko's love for Montambu was true, and she was fearless, the reckless kind of fearless which only the strongest love can bring. She took a deep breath. No, Danshiro, I belong to another, and I will never, ever marry you. Danshiro's jealousy and rage overcame him. This woman who had foiled their plans and defied him and still refused his affection no matter what he tried. This woman who dared to risk her own life for her love. Well, she need risk it no longer. Danshiro drew his sword. One swipe was enough. He was fast. So fast that Okiko didn't have time to scream or run. By the time she realized what he was going to do, it had happened, and her blood was spilling out of her. Where to hide the body? Somewhere deep, which daylight never shines upon, and no human eyes ever glimpse. Somewhere like a well? Yes, the well! Danshiro gathered Okiko's body into his arms, and with a last wistful look at her beauty, a lament to that which he would never own, he threw her into the castle's well. Secrets. Leave them to rot in the somber damp underground. Okiku's absence raised no questions. After all, everyone believed she had stolen the plate, and they knew that Tetsuzan took no prisoners. Only Montanobu and his companions continued to fight Tetsuzan. Eventually, they were successful. He was overthrown, and Lord Noramoto returned to Himeji, and Danshiro's terrible crime was discovered. In tribute to her love and bravery, Okiku was enshrined in Junisho Jinja. This modest, tranquil shrine is tucked away down a side street, quietly emitting its charm into the city. And as for the well, once the sun began to set and the shadows lengthened, people started avoiding it. There was talk of hearing strange sounds like whispers from within and glimpses of the ethereal figure of a woman. For the few who dared to venture to the well in the darkest hours of the night, if they listened carefully, they would realize that the whispering voice coming from the well was counting. Five, six, seven, eight, nine. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Never 10. One missing plate, one restless spirit eternally searching for it, counting every night, never leaving her watery grave. I really like this version, by the way, and I will totally link this website in the show notes because there's some wonderful photographs here as well. I am now clicking on another link. This is Amelia Starling, by the way. And she wrote or read, it's an audio. Hang on. I thought it was going to be a transcript. She wrote a poem based on this Japanese ghost story. Oh, I don't think that I can play it here for you. I was thinking about trying to play it for you. I tell you what, I will definitely link this website and maybe you can follow the links, or there's a download where you can download the file, but let me check. Oh, file not found. So we may not get to hear this, but maybe if you Google it, if I give you the information, you'll be able to find it. But kudos to her. Kudos to Amelia Starling. This is really wonderful. Really wonderful. I like this version. All right. And that is it for this week's episode on scary waters and scary things around water. Honestly, it wasn't so much into all of the ghost stories. You know, like I told you, I saved the best one for last. And I could probably find some crazy stories about those other places. And I might expand on them in the future. But I just kind of wanted to lead up on some historical areas. Some things you might not have known about world wars. That's one of the reasons I chose them, the atrocities. I had looked up some things about Greece. I found this one page, 30 creepy places in Greece, and it ended up being a ton of them with the Nazi occupation and just thousands and thousands and thousands of dead people in prisons and stuff. And it's just horrible. And the reason I didn't keep that episode is because it felt really trite just reading off a list of 30 creepy places. So look out in the future. I may possibly do something from Greece. This is a lot longer episode than I expected. Maybe not once I edit all of my foibles out of it and my tongue trippings. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope that you are having a good
first, I don't know, maybe for you guys, you know, officially about to be, if it's October, close enough tomorrow. foray into spooky seasons and pumpkin spice and pumpkins and pumpkin patches. And I may go to one today or next week. And I really want some apple cider donuts. Can you believe I don't think I've ever had any? Everybody's talking about them. I'm like, they must be so moist. I must have one. So I'm going to find a pumpkin patch. And please check out my latest book, Dark Wings. And I bring that up because I've finished my omnibus. 5 books of a series retyped, edited into one giant volume. I'm going to have it out, as far as I know, by Halloween. I thought that would be auspicious. And I am taking the very first volume, the re-edited version, with a new cover that will be released here very shortly, within the week. Paris Immortal, A Vampire Tale. As an introduction, I might do it for free, or at least very, very cheap. Gives you a taste, give you a teaser if you've never read any of them. These first started coming out in 2008. I finished about 2016. A lot of people really like them. This is the part that some of you may go, damn you, but this is the whole point, right? I'm going to put that one out as a teaser, probably take down the old versions because I've re-edited all of them. And you'll have to buy the omnibus for the rest, unless you really sweet talk me. I don't know. I might consider it. And find me on all my socials, and you can keep up the news, pinkyswearpress.com. Email me, sroite@pinkyswearpress.com, if you have any good ghosty stories. And I am going to end here so I can edit this and get it out today. Pa-pa-pa-pow. Bye-bye. Ooh, and I'm about to watch Hocus Pocus 2. Amok-amok-amok. And then I'll go back and watch the old one again for the 50 billionth time. Okay, now I'm really done. Bye-bye. Oh, another glorious morning makes me sick.